Good evening and welcome to Indie Radio News, the weekly radio news program from The Independent, a free progressive monthly newspaper and online news site based here in New York. We cover social justice movements and the issues they are fighting for, both here in the city and around the world. We are your hosts, Elia Gran and Lydia McMullen-Laird.
Beginning with headlines, deportation flights are big business. The U.S. government has spent $1 billion on these flights in the last decade, and the Trump administration is seeking to raise the Immigration and Customs Enforcement budget for charter flights by 30%. ICE Air transports detained immigrants between American cities and, for those with final removal orders, back to their home countries. About 100,000 people a year are deported on such flights. While Mexican immigrants are generally flown to southern U.S. cities and then driven to the border so they can cross over, Central Americans have to be transported by air. The large numbers of Mexicans who used to cross the border have largely been replaced by migrants from three impoverished Central American countries: El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And in climate news, almost 200 nations, including the world's top greenhouse gas producers, China and the United States, have adopted a set of rules for the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. Officials at the UN climate talks, which ended late Saturday in the Polish city of Katowice, agreed on how countries should report their emissions and efforts to reduce them. But negotiators delayed other key decisions until next year, a move that frustrated environmentalists and countries that wanted more ambitious goals. The majority of the rulebook for the Paris Agreement has been created, which is something to be thankful for, said Mohamed Adao, a climate policy expert at Christian Aid. But the fact that countries had to be dragged kicking and screaming to the finish line shows that some nations have not woken up. The talks took place against the backdrop of growing concern among scientists that global warming is proceeding faster than governments are responding to it. Last month, a study found that global warming will worsen disasters such as the deadly California wildfires and the powerful hurricanes that have hit the United States this year. And legislation to ease federal sentencing laws is pitting conservatives against each other as Donald Trump is looking to score a major legislative win before the end of the year. The Senate is expected to advance the bill today. Final passage would come later in the week, but not until the chamber has debated and voted on a series of amendments. Republican Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas and others want to exclude more prisoners from an earlier release to a halfway house or home confinement. They also want to require that crime victims are notified before a prisoner is granted supervised release. Supporters of the bill warn the amendments could cause the compromise to unravel. If the legislation passes in the Senate, the House is expected to approve it quickly.
Prime Minister Theresa May said today that the postponed vote in Parliament on Britain's Brexit agreement with the European Union will be held the week of January 14th, more than a month after it was originally scheduled and just 10 weeks before Britain leaves the European Union. Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the main opposition Labour Party, said he would submit a motion of no confidence to the Prime Minister over her delays. Losing the vote on such a motion would increase the pressure on May, but unlike a no-confidence vote in the government as a whole, it wouldn't trigger a process leading to the fall of the government and an early election. In local news, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's agenda for 2019 puts the legalization of recreational marijuana and fixing New York City's crumbling subway system among his top priorities for the start of his third term. In a speech Monday, the Democratic governor talked about liberal accomplishments while vowing to continue to fight Trump administration policies he says are detrimental to New Yorkers. And Patricia Okumu, the woman who climbed the base of the Statue of Liberty on July 4th to protest the separation of families at the Mexican border, has been convicted of misdemeanor charges. She choked up as she testified before a federal magistrate judge at her trial today. She said images from the border gave her nightmares. The prosecutor says Okumu endangered herself, rescuers, and thousands of Liberty Island visitors when she climbed to the feet of the statue. Okumu testified that she couldn't live with the sight of children in cages without bringing the issue to a wider audience. The charges include trespassing and carry a potential penalty of up to 18 months in prison. Ahead of her trial here in New York, Okumu protested Trump's immigration policy by climbing the Eiffel Tower in Paris. We connect live to this morning's trial with Savitri D from the Stop Shopping Choir. Hello, Savitri.
Savitri, could you tell us a little bit about how the ambience was outside the courthouse this morning? Right. So at 500 Pearl Street, you know, everyone who's coming into the courthouse gathers on the Worth side of the street. And everyone was gathered there, and there were people with signs, and there was people from a lot of different groups around the city gathered, as well as some press early in the morning, waiting to go in with Patricia to her trial. I'd say the energy was really good. Patricia herself is really clear and has a lot of focus and is constantly just redirecting every question towards the children. So when someone asks her, how are you feeling? Are you nervous? Are you scared? She says, I'm not thinking about any of that. I'm thinking about the children. And she says, return the children. So I think her clarity and focus really gathers people around her and makes the whole thing feel really strong.
Excellent. Thanks so much. You went into the courthouse actually where the trial was taking place. Can you tell us a little bit about how that went?
Sure. So we were in court from 9:30 to about 3 p.m. And mostly the witnesses were law enforcement from Liberty Island, and Patricia herself was called to the stand. You know, the facts in the case were very clear and pretty indisputable. And so really we were just reviewing what actually happened in front of the judge. But of course, law enforcement show up in their costumes, and you know how that goes. They always say they're just protecting the person, and in any case, it went on for several hours, and then the judge did issue a verdict, guilty on all three counts, and the sentencing will take place on March 5th. And again, I would just say Patricia herself was just once again refocusing us all towards the children and saying this is only about the children. And so she's doing a great job of like carrying that story, carrying that torch for the rest of us, for the world, really, to like get these kids out of these camps. It's still happening. Family separation is real, and it's happening right now.
And Google announced today that it will spend more than $1 billion to build a new office complex in New York City that will allow the internet search giant to double the number of people it employs there. It is the tech industry's latest major expansion beyond the Seattle-San Francisco Bay Corridor. Google opened its first office in New York nearly 20 years ago and now employs 7,000 people in the city. The company said earlier this year that it would buy the Chelsea Market building for $2.4 billion and plan to lease more space at Pier 57, both along the Hudson about a mile north of the newly announced complex. The news follows Seattle-based Amazon's announcement a month ago that it would set up a new headquarters in New York's Long Island City neighborhood and in Arlington, Virginia. And there was another steep chart today for the Dow. It plunged 500 points, its second straight drop of that size and its fourth big decline this month. Longtime market favorites like Microsoft and Amazon took heavy losses today. Healthcare companies also fell sharply. A measure of small company stocks fell into a bear market, a decline of 20% below their recent peak. The market is now well into the red for the year, and the S&P 500 index is trading at its lowest level since October 2017.
Of a building in Lower Manhattan received notice last week that work crews hired by Jared Kushner's Westminster City Living contaminated their building with lead-laden construction dust. The dust was from demolition work being done in the building. A report by NYC Department of Health and Mental Hygiene shows elevated levels of lead in 4 out of 5 samples collected in the building. One of the samples had levels of lead nearly 10 times higher than acceptable EPA standards. For more on the story, we're joined today by David Dupuy, one of the tenants in the building, and Brandon Kilbasa, the director of organizing at the Cooper Square Committee, and the coordinator of the Lead Dust Free NYC campaign. Let's start with you, David. Can you describe what happened in your building last week?
Well, it was the week before last, and there was construction going on in the apartment below me. They were doing a demolition, and I think they got to the point where they were doing the ceiling, and they were really kind of slugging away at it with whatever tools they had. And there were several kind of big collapsing, crashing noises, and whooshes of air kind of came through my apartment with a big cloud of white dust that floated in the air about 6 feet up in the air and was just kind of suspended there. And I could feel it on my skin, on my eyelids. It was kind of rubbing them. It was a bit gritty. And in the back of my throat, you know, it was kind of, I was inhaling it, and there was definitely a burning feeling in my throat. So I kind of washed my face off and decided to, I had to get out of there because I had a sense that it was going to be like that all day, and it was going to take quite a while for the stuff in the air to settle before I could kind of go back in and see, you know, get a feeling of what's going on.
And what are you most worried about as a tenant of this building with this lead-contaminated dust? What are you worried about?
I'm most worried about the effect on my health, on my lungs, on my, you know, nervous system. I'm worried about especially what other sort of, you know, toxic heavy metals or things may be in that dust as well that I'm not even aware of, asbestos, things like that.
And you said you left the building. Are you back now, or are you living somewhere else until this gets resolved?
I went back later that day, and they had done, I think pretty much finished whatever major mess they were making, and they were carrying it out in garbage cans, uncovered garbage cans, so there was like dust all through the hallways, and I went up, and I just thought I had to take a look. So the cloud was down, but everything in my apartment was covered with like a white dust. So that's when I got in touch with Brandon and Cooper Square and trying to figure out what I was going to do next.
Let's turn now to Brandon Kielbasa. He's the director of organizing at the Cooper Square Committee and the co-coordinator of the Lead Dust Free NYC campaign. Brandon, how common is lead contamination in New York buildings, and why aren't there any laws to prevent the sort of thing that happened in David's building?
So it's unfortunately really common what David went through. We're seeing community members come in practically every other week here to our office in the Lower East Side complaining about the construction dust that's flooding their buildings or in their individual units, as David experienced, from work that's being done in their buildings. In New York City, there are actually really good laws around this issue, but they're not enforced fully, and the regulations that surround them are really not where they need to be. So what happens is that landlords and the demolition crews and construction crews they bring into their buildings aren't being really penalized or held accountable to what they should be. The laws outline an entire kind of set of safe work practices that landlords are supposed to use when they're working in a building that is built before 1960. There's a presumed presence of lead in all buildings that are built before 1960 in New York City, so landlords are supposed to do stuff like tarp off the doors with plastic sheathing and cover the vents with plastic sheathing. And then, of course, to control the dust dispersion, they're supposed to cart the debris out of the building in closed containers or in bags, not in open containers. And, and stuff that David was describing is not the way it's supposed to be done. And that's why the building, from what we can tell, it was contaminated. And, you know, upwards of 10 times the permissible levels.
So you mentioned the landlords, and this is a Jared Kushner building, but this type of dynamic exists all across the city. Can you describe that a little bit more? Like, why don't tenants have more power in situations like this?
Right now, the way it works is that if you're experiencing this particular problem, your first recourse is to call 311 and to try to get the Department of Health and the Healthy Homes Unit out to your building. That unit would come out, and they would look around and see if the safe work practices are being utilized, and then they would go ahead and take samples from different areas within the common areas, about, you know, 10 to 15 typically, and then they bring those samples back to a laboratory and they test. The process as it is really not sufficient. The landlords, if they are found to have contaminated the building, they'll receive something called a commissioner's order from the city, from the Department of Health. And then they're supposed to submit test swabs back to the city showing that they cleaned up the problem. So the city is really relying on landlords to correct the problem and in good faith send back, you know, samples that show that they're now doing the work in a way that's different and controlled. We feel like the way that, you know, these landlords skirt the laws, what we've seen and the ways that we've seen them skirt the laws proves to us that they really can't be trusted to do the verification themselves. And, you know, we think that, you know, if it's up to the bad-acting landlord and the speculator to do work in a way that's, you know, a slower, more deliberate process, that's probably going to cost them more by hiring the right work crews that know how to, you know, use the safe work practices versus to do it as fast and cheap as possible and just to get it done with hopes that they won't be caught we see like 9 times out of 10, the landlords do it the fast and cheap way and hope they don't get caught. So we're working with a whole coalition of community members called Lead Dust Free NYC that's basically trying to push the city council and the city administration right now to, you know, basically strengthen the laws and enforcement, especially the existing law, carried out more effectively.
So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Indie Radio News on WBAI 99.5. We're speaking right now with Brandon Kielbasa, the director of organizing at the Cooper Square Committee. Brandon, what can people who are concerned about this in their own buildings, some of our listeners who live in New York who might be concerned about this, what can they do to make sure they're safe from high levels of lead? Or what can they do if they end up in a situation like David?
I think the first thing to do is to start, you know, calling in complaints to the city. As much as that process is at this point, I can call it a broken process for this particular issue, it's still the best thing to do, to call 311 and get a complaint in with the city and try to get somebody out to test the lead dust. That would be the Department of Health. After that, reach out to your local tenants' rights organization and even your local city council member and start to, you know, basically explain what's going on and say that you're going to need help. A tenants' rights organization can help you or the tenants organize in the building, and there's a lot of different tools at their disposal if they're doing that. We've helped tenants who get these test results in the past bring their landlords to court and force them to comply with safe work practices. So there's stuff you can do collectively. We're really see a totally night and day difference between buildings that organize around this and those that don't. So that would be my biggest recommendation.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us today, Brandon. We'll have to leave it there for now. Stay tuned for part two of our show, where we'll be talking to Steve Wishnia about tenants' rights in New York City right after the break.
Welcome back to Indie Radio News on WBAI 99.5. In this second part of the show, we're going to be talking to Steven Wishnia. The movement to strengthen New York State's rent controls and tenant protection laws is going into 2019 with two great advantages that it didn't have before. One is a solid Democratic majority in the state Senate, and the second one is a growing tenant organization in several upstate cities. We talked to Steven Wishnia, Indie contributor editor, who has covered tenant issues in New York for the Indie for over 15 years. His most recent article was published in the December issue of The Independent, which you can find in news boxes all over the city. The article was titled, "Will Dems in the New York State Make 2019 the Year of the Tenant?" Hello, Steven.
Hi, how are you?
I guess the most obvious conversation right now would be, what do you think of the previous conversation of the first part where we were talking about the Kushner buildings?
I'm actually writing about that for Gothamist right now. I should have a story up on it later this week. But, you know, that's, you know, one of the things that the loopholes in the rent stabilization laws lead to is that by having vacancy deregulation where landlords can deregulate apartments if the rent is over $27.33 a month once the tenant moves out and the laws against illegal overcharges are not well enforced, that gives landlords an incentive to empty buildings because they make a lot more money doing that. They can, you know, renovate vacant apartments and apply the costs of the renovation or the exaggerated costs of the renovation, as the case may be, to the rent. And if the construction creates a nuisance for tenants such as lead dust, well, the door is that way if they want to leave. In fact, it's so common that people like, you know, Brandon Kielbasa at Cooper Square have coined the term construction as harassment. You know, this is not the only building on the Lower East Side this is happening in. Other landlords, you know, Stephen Croman's pretty notorious for it.
And going back to your article, you mentioned the changes in the New York Senate. Can you explain how that's going to affect these illegal?
That's huge. There's actually two things that are issues as far as the state goes. One is the actual laws, and the other is the enforcement. Until this year, Republicans have had effective control over the New York State Senate for more than 50 years. There have been a couple times in the last 10 years where Democrats got a majority, and that was blocked by either by, you know, Democrats in one form or another, allying with the Republicans, most recently with the Independent Democratic Conference, that gave the Republicans, the vast majority of whom are from outside the city but take tons of money from the New York State real estate lobby, you know, veto power, control over what kind of bills get to the floor in the Senate, because the Assembly is Democratic and the Senate is Republican. There's a term of one house bill. The Assembly will pass a bill to repeal vacancy decontrol. It goes nowhere in the Senate, doesn't even get a committee hearing. So this time, first in September, six of the eight IDC members lost in the primary, including Jeff Klein, who is the leader, who lost to, you know, Alexandra Biaggi. And Democrats also gained several seats upstate. So instead of, you know, being having a 31-32 minority along with the IDC, they now have a 39-24 majority. So that's huge.
And so this is 2019 could be looking at the year of the tenant, right? Also because of the growing support from grassroots organizations, tenant organizations that are located in Albany, Rochester, Binghamton, and amongst others. Can you explain a little bit the importance of the collaboration between upstate communities? And also, has this ever happened before, this level of connection between the organizations?
Not as far as I know of. You know, rent regulations were largely a New York City and its inner suburbs thing, but housing costs have been going up all over the state. You know, even in a place like Rochester, which is losing population, you get, you know, you apartments that they kick people out, and then they're, you know, charging $1,300 a month. And as Ryan Acuff, the organizer I spoke to for the article, said, you know, yeah, you know, rents are lower upstate than they are in the city, but people's salaries are also lower. The state actually has a lower minimum wage for upstate than it does for the city. So it's becoming much more of an issue. I didn't mention this in the article, but it's also an issue for trailer parks, because people in trailer parks own their trailers, but they don't own the land. They rent the land, and speculators have been buying up, you know, these, you know, mobile home places and raising the rents on the land. You know, what are people going to do? It's a lot, you know, trouble to move a trailer.
So, Stephen, looking at 2019 and with these changes that are definitely going to be implemented, what can we look forward to?
It's still going to be in Albany. I don't know if it's going to be in the budget. Michael McKee, who's a longtime, you know, tenant activist and organizer, is involved with Met Council on Housing. He's also treasurer of Tenants PAC, which raises money for pro-tenant candidates. So he probably knows more about, you know, the politics of rent control in the New York State legislature than anybody else. Says the main person to watch out for is Governor Cuomo, because he does not want to alienate his real estate contributors. And there are a lot of things. There's a lot of sentiment for strengthening the rent laws, repealing vacancy decontrol, repealing the preferential rent loophole, which says that a landlord can give you a discount, but they can raise it up to the legal rent whenever your lease expires. So people might rent an apartment at $1,300 and then they sign a new lease and it's $1,900. To reform MCIs, major capital improvements, in which the cost can be, you know, added on to the rent. The same thing with individual apartment improvements or renovations of vacant apartments. This, you know, whole agenda. And the new element in it is extending the Emergency Tenant Protection Act of 1974, which allows local governments to enact rent regulations, rent stabilization, to the whole state. Right now, it's limited to just New York City, Nassau, Westchester, and Rockland counties. So it would give, you know, Rochester, or Albany, or, you know, trailer park in Akron, New York, the right to enact its own rent regulations. You know, the thing is, real estate contributes tons of money to legislatures, and it's very easy to water a bill down. you know, you can change one word. You can change shall to should. And that means instead of it being required, it means it's just a recommendation.
Thank you much, so much, Dan Wishnev, for to find your article. Go to the December issue of The Independent, which is out in the streets starting today. And thank you very much for being here in the studio with us.
Thank you so much for joining us today. We'll be taking a break for the holidays, but we'll be back with Indie Radio News in 2 weeks on Monday, January 7th at 6 p.m. And our wonderful co-host, Elia Gran, will be moving back to Spain, so this is her last show. Elia, thank you so much for all your excellent local reporting and the many wonderful interviews you've done here on Indie Radio News.
Thank you, Lydia. I could not have done this, obviously, without our team, and I'm very happy that Indie Radio News is such a great program and that we've made a very solid and amazing work together with the newspaper The Independent, and also working with you has been amazing. Thank you, Lydia.
We will definitely miss you around here at WBAI. Starting in January, Peter Rue, the associate editor of The Independent, will be our new co-host. So stay tuned and see you all in the new year. Thank you for listening. You can catch us every Monday at 6 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 FM for all the latest from Indie Radio News. You can find this month's print edition of The Independent at our outdoor news boxes across the city and in local libraries, independent bookstores, and social movement centers. Follow all our latest coverage online at independent.org, that's indie with a Y, and via social media. To let us know what you think of today's show, send news tips, or find out how to subscribe to The Independent's print edition, we can be reached at 212-904-1282 or contact at independent.org. Thank you so much to WBAI for hosting our show, and see you next week.